This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters, and culture. Colonization and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hello and welcome back to Auspol Snack Pod, the podcast where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian politics and news with a side of crispy memes, and we're also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group, which, for the next month, will be named ACAB Shitposting. My name's Noon, on Facebook I'm Ono Funkenstein, and I'm the admin and creator of Auspol Shitposting, and with me is my co-host.
Hey, Zach the Snack, a happy ACAB to you and yours.
Thank you, Zach.
It has been an absolutely enormous news week, not only with the regular stock standard Australian political bullshit, but obviously the massive news around the world has been the nationwide uprising, the protests over the police killing of George Floyd in the USA, and all of the ripples that has sent out across the globe.
Yeah, that's right. And we're actually recording this intro later than we recorded the rest of the show because we went to the BLM rally here in Narm or Melbourne. And we wanted to give a big shout out to the organisers, Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance, and also the other groups and individuals who helped organise it, and the speakers. There were some really amazing speeches. But we, yeah, just wanted to say that a couple of things have changed since we recorded the show. The main thing being the New South Wales Supreme Court said that the rally in Sydney was going to be illegal because of coronavirus. And then while we were standing in the crowd listening to the speeches, the news came through that the Court of Appeals had found that it was legal. So that's some good news. Yeah, but we are doing basically a show about black lives and police killings. We start off kind of talking about the American situation and the way that the Australian media has dealt with it, and then sort of move back to what's going on in Australia.
Yeah, so our main segment at the end of the show is going to be sort of remembering in detail a number of high-profile killings of Aboriginal people by police here in Australia. So be warned that this is quite a heavy show at parts, and we'll give more specific warnings as we go along. But there's it's also important to note that that segment has the voices of Aboriginal people who have passed away in it. So a heads up on that one. And we also wanted to just mention that we're going to link to fundraisers that are being set up, that have been set up by the families and communities of the people that we talk about in this episode, and some others, I think, you know, about paying the rent and showing financial support for Indigenous people. But before we get into all of that, we are going to start off the week with a light little just a light little aperitif, something off topic, a little, just something that, you know, brought a little positivity into our lives this week. Positivity Corner. This is just a little something that made us smile this week because we like it when our Prime Minister has his shit-eating grin wiped off his face. Well, I mean, he didn't actually get wiped off his face. Usually when he's eating shit, he just grins harder. But he was at a press conference, he was holding a press conference earlier in the week to announce Home Builder, which is something that we didn't have time to get into this week, but we'll be talking about it in future. But essentially, it's the latest in the government's futile attempts to stave off a recession, this time specifically by giving boomers money to put a second story on their house. And in the middle of the press conference, he was having it outside a bit of land that's about to be developed. And a bunch of the people who were part of the press were standing on this guy's front lawn, and he popped out of his front front door and just basically told him to fuck off. Not in as many words, but look, I'll play the clip.
1,000 Australians.
Everyone get off the grass, please.
Sure. Let's just move back from there.
Hey, guys, I've just reseated that.
Yeah, please, sorry, off the thing.
Yeah, I mean, what more needs to be said than that? I've just reseated that. Like, show a little fucking respect, please.
I love it because I feel like, you know, you kind of commented on his shit-eating grin, but I feel like you can see the words in the inside of his head being like, don't you know I'm the fucking Prime Minister? And then, like, translating that out of his mouth as like, all right, just step off, please. Yeah,
come on, guys, please, off the thing. Anyway, that was a nice little ray of sunshine in our week. But that's probably enough on Positivity Corner. Noon, do you want to take us through who fucked up this week?
You fucked up.
Yes, and so this is kind of the start of the rest of the show of a Black Lives Matter themed thing, and all of our segments are going to be related to that. This one is more about sort of cultural genocide, I guess. This was a story that we touched on last week about Rio Tinto blowing up those 46,000-year-old cultural heritage sites. And on Friday morning, Chris Salisbury, who's Rio Tinto's executive in charge of iron ore, went on Radio National Breakfast. And this was a long and torturous interview. It was 22 minutes long. I rarely hear interviews that long on ABC Radio.
When you linked it to me, I was like, Jesus Christ, what a marathon. And it felt like an hour.
It did. It was a full train wreck. I think a week or two ago, we innovated the concept of a bingle interview, but this was a multi-car pileup on a train track.
Full eight cars, like, freight train, and every single car has come off the rails.
So there was a lot of shit in it. The interviewer, Hamish McDonald, who I'm not a big fan of, kept saying, like, on the 27th of May, you put out a statement that said you were sorry that the PKKP people had not previously expressed concerns. That was not correct, was it? And he asked this question like three or four times, and Chris Salisbury kept saying things like, we're sorry for the distress. We've been working in close partnership with the PKKP people for 17 years. We thought we had a shared understanding about the future of the site. We're not intending to cause pain or anguish, but never addressed the fact that they had blatantly lied to the general public. And as I said, it's 22 minutes of uninterrupted this guy just eating his own foot, or like putting his foot in his mouth. It's mixed up some metaphors there, but yeah, it's just awful. And Hamish McDonald sort of ends up the interview saying, it doesn't sound like there was really any penalty for you. And the dude goes, well, certainly we're feeling the pain through this process, and we share the stress of the traditional owners that this happened. I share this distress, and as I've said, we're committed to doing something about this. And we're going to make sure this never happens again, certainly not on one of our sites. As if he was outraged at the suggestion that something like this might happen on one of their sites.
Just pathetic that, like, new information has come out that they knew about, like, how significant this archaeological site was well in advance. And in fact, the advice they'd gotten from the expert archaeologists that they consulted was that it was the most important archaeological site
totally.
In Australia, potentially.
In the whole of Australia,
like,
yeah.
That's the magnitude of, like, cultural history that they were destroying when they did this. And yeah, he was completely incapable of answering any of the questions. He refused to take any kind of personal culpability. And he refused to address the fact that, obviously, the community consultation work, which he kept saying again and again, you know, we thought we had a shared understanding. We've worked closely with the PKKP people. Well, bro, if that was true, then you would have fucking known. And the truth is, you did, and you ignored it.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that frustrated me about the interview was that, you know, you're never going to get anything other than this from a mainstream media outlet in Australia. But inherent in the premise of the questions is the implication that there is a right way to mine on country. That there's a right way to conduct extractivist business on stolen land. You know, I just once would love to hear one of these mining CEOs backed into a corner and actually have to say that they think that making money is more important than land rights. And because that's the premise that the entire industry is built on. But it's like, I don't know, Hamish was, what's his last name? McDonald?
McDonald, yeah.
Hamish McDonald was so kind of set on getting, on trying to sort of trip this guy up on one of a number of very specific questions. And the guy just, you know, he fumbled and was useless and made an ass of himself, but he didn't admit anything. And I don't know. I just I find the questioning around this kind of stuff to be very frustrating from the mainstream media.
Well, on the theme of Hamish McDonald being a bit shitty, immediately after this interview, he interviewed another person who's an activist shareholder who owns shares in Rio, and she called for Chris Salisbury and everyone, quote, in that chain of command to resign / be fired, and also called for reparations in the terms of multiple trillions of assets in Rio, basically like giving Rio to the PKK people as like partial reparations. But in that interview with the shareholder, Hamish McDonald said that overnight he'd been leaked emails from the Rio Tinto management to Rio Tinto staff, basically saying that this was the media's fault, that this was a big deal, they didn't do anything wrong, and that it was the like appropriate for them to blow up the shit. And why the fuck did he not raise this with the iron ore dude? I have no idea. Why raise it with this uninvolved activist shareholder who's calling for his resignation? It's just like shitty journalism, dude. Come on. Like, press the people in power, not the randoms who are on the side, you know?
Whatever. Look, I mean, by ABC standards, I suppose, in some ways, it wasn't a terrible interview. Like, he did press the guy, just, you know... Look, anyway, whatever. We've discussed this long enough, and you and I have both well documented on this podcast our issues with the way that establishment media conducts themselves.
I just very quickly want to explicitly draw the connection that, like, we're talking about Black Lives Matter and no one died as a result of this explosion, but cultural genocide is... It directly affects the health and well-being of First Nations people, destroying their land and destroying their connection with the land, and... ignoring their sovereignty and preventing them from like legal recourse, as we've seen at multiple stages in this thing. These are all part of the same system as the people who shoot black people. You know, that it's the same thing happening, and it's important to remember that when we see this cultural genocide, that it's a key component of the like genocide of humans. So I just wanted to draw that before we moved on.
For sure. Now it's time for our blurst take.
It was the best of
takes.
It was the blurst of
takes.
You stupid monkey.
This week we are awarding blurst take to the nation of Australia. A nation of racist dead shits, of bozos and clowns who continue to fail upwards in a political and media landscape that is completely devoid of any kind of integrity or any kind of value. The shit that was coming out of the mouths of our politicians this week in reference to the Black Lives Matter protests over the death of George Floyd in the United States was fucking humiliating. These people are absolutely useless. Worse than that, they are culpable for perpetuating the continued justification of violence against marginalized people. And I'm going to get into what our Prime Minister said and what some other dead shits from his fucking political party have said. But Noon, do you want to start with some of our foremost, our premier professional racists over at Channel 7 and what they've been up to?
Yeah, absolutely. So I got muted on Twitter this week because I retweeted every tweet in the thread by someone called Keaton Joshi, who's at KeatonJ0 on Twitter.
He's a climate researcher, and
totally.
Definitely worth a follow, but he also writes about racism in Australia.
And I retweeted each of these tweets with something along the lines of fuck Sunrise, fuck Channel 7, and after retweeting all like 15 of them or whatever, I got muted, so that's funny, but it was probably worth it. Ketan, I don't know how to say his name, Ketan?
Ketan.
Was basically talking about how fucked the reporting in Australia is, and said there's a good rundown on how American media are getting better at understanding what's happening here, but it feels like Australia and UK media are both blind to the possibility that police are actively working to hurt innocent people. Tellingly, people from the US retweeted footage of seven Sunrise journalists, as in journalists from Sunrise on Seven, not Seven of them, getting attacked by cops. But there wasn't much mention of the context of that media outlet, its views on race, and Australia's media's position in general. We'll write about that later when America wakes up. And it goes on, Channel 7 has specifically kept their focus on looting and the police being targeted, despite their own journalists being savaged by American cops. They actually did address it once, but they wheeled out an Australian journalist who has explicitly called for the removal of restrictions on hate speech and the freedom to publish extremely racist cartoons. What we're seeing is an effort to erase racism from the conversation. And even that article fails to highlight that CNN's black journo was arrested while its white journalists roam free. Draws the connection that the media pushing for like free speech and for like ending 18C and stuff about free speech on racist discrimination is reinforcing the police violence that led to the seven Sunrise journalists being punched. And he says, anyway, the first goal here really should be, when it comes to naming and describing the root cause of a problem, do better than ice cream, in reference to Ben and Jerry calling for a dismantling of white supremacy. And, you know, it isn't healthy to formulate the press freedom as the right to publish racism and racist attacks alongside the right to remain wholly untouched while police attack peaceful protesters and black journalists. There's a deep circularity to this that's missed.
That's just so extremely well put.
Yeah. And there's been a lot of stuff on Twitter of, like, all of the times that Sunrise was racist as fuck and, like, the times that they were, like, got Pauline Hanson on to talk about why Uluru should stay available for settlers to climb. And
but they had her, like, prior to her re-election to the Senate, they gave her a regular segment. They are, like, largely responsible for her re-entry into Australian politics. I think that that is absolutely fucking key to remember. You know, it's not some kind of abstract idea about it's bad in the abstract that they're racist. Like, they have actual tangible influence on the political conversation and political action in this country. They gave Pauline a platform, and months later she was elected. Like, that is how it fucking works.
They interviewed neo-Nazi Blair Cottrell as, like, activist or something. That was the, like, description they gave him. They're just not complicit, but actively empowering, like, raging racists. Not even, like, regular Australian politician levels of racists. Like, it's just horrible. And they're so shocked that they got attacked by cops. They're like, but we're white and Australian. That's not who the cops are for. Yeah, anyway, so that's all I wanted. It was maybe a bit too much about Ketton, but it was a good thread. You should follow him on Twitter.
For sure.
Take us through some more blurst takes, Zach?
Oh, yeah, boy. An embarrassment of fucking riches over here in the blurst take section, I tell you what. All right, I'm going to start off with Dave Sharma, member for Wentworth, Liberal MP. That's the fancy boy seat that was once held by Malcolm Turnbull, ousted by Karen Phelps was then elected there and then lost it pretty quickly. Dave Sharma kind of, you know, like all the other, like, recent MPs that have held that seat, kind of is sort of presented as this, like, oh, relatively progressive for a liberal, pretty sensible guy. Likes to cast himself in that light. But this tweet from him about the uprising in the US, he says, "The death of George Floyd was a shocking and sickening act that clearly needs to be investigated, but what started as a legitimate and thoughtful protest has been hijacked by violence. I urge everyone to engage in peaceful protest." Now, obviously, reports came out of the States pretty quickly after that people had seen this tweet from Dave Sharma and decided to call it on the rioting.
Yeah, yeah, and that was really the factor that did it, was this tweet from Dave.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, I think we should all be thankful to him that he used his immense platform to speak out for being sensible, being thoughtful, and doing what the cops tell you. So thanks for the advice there, Dave. Also, by the way, fuck you, shut the fuck up. You don't get to decide what a legitimate or thoughtful protest looks like. You don't get to decide that people who are damaging property are outside infiltrators hijacking the protest. You don't get to decide what a proper expression of anger against a racist system looks like, and you need to shut your fucking mouth.
Speaking I'm sorry, you've just reminded me, my housemate pointed out that, like, people getting so mad about, like, an Apple store getting smashed in or whatever, they're like, oh, property damage, but these 46,000-year-old caves that were blown up literally just for the sake of profit, not for any, like, good reason, that doesn't count as property that shouldn't be damaged for some reason. Anyway, sorry, I know that
yeah,
was a where's
your,
done with that
where's
story,
your tweet, like, about the vandalism being committed by mining companies,
yeah.
Dave? You're so even-handed. Fucking clean your act up. Dickhead. All right. I'm going to use the same attempted segue. Speaking of dickhead, here's one from Scott Morrison, who... This man is just an absolute content machine for this podcast.
Yeah.
Like, he just can't stop himself saying hilarious and extremely silly shit. So, I'm just going to read this quote from him. I saw a good meme on the weekend. Strong start. Martin Luther King didn't change anything by burning anything down or by looting any shops. As upsetting and terrible that the murder that took place, and it is shocking, that also just made me cringe, I just think to myself how wonderful a country is Australia. There's no need to import things happening in other countries here to Australia. Australia is not the United States. So, yeah, I mean, that's a pretty revelatory statement of fact there. Australia is not the United States. And I know, you and I have been confused about that point for a while.
Yes, tried to vote in Colorado several times. And it wasn't entirely clear why I couldn't. It turns out it's because Australia is not the United States. Which, you know, given that we join all of their wars, I think it's understandable
it's
that we might make that mistake, you know. But
It's a weird one, but luckily Morrison cleared that up. Also that Morrison is clearly having the most dog shit boomer memes circulated in his social media.
What the fuck?
It's just hilarious to me. He's just like scrolling, sees a little MLK graphic. He's like,
that's
a
so
good
true.
Point.
MLK loved cops.
Yeah, we have boomer posters at the highest offices in our fucking, in this country. It's so embarrassing. And
I was just going to say, I saw a good tweet. But are you going to say something of actual relevance? No, okay.
No, go on.
It was from Osman Faruqi, who we've talked about a lot on the show of mixed react fame. But he tweeted something that was like, millennials trying to impress their date. And Scott Morrison, and there's like, you know, a handshaking emoji. And what they're agreeing on is, I saw a good meme on the weekend. And I thought that was very true and really sums up what our show is about.
Yeah, we sit right at that intersection of memes that the Prime Minister likes and memes that the Prime Minister is in. And look, as many people point out all the time, Martin Luther King's rhetoric has been co-opted and sanitized by people who try to discredit any form of effective protest by African-American people. And so obviously it's very fitting that Morrison would throw his lot in with them, because it's a meme designed to make him feel good about the fact that he's like part of this system and actively perpetuating it. So obviously the takeaway from this is memes go all the way to the top, guys. So don't ever let anyone tell you that memeing isn't important, okay? You meme hard enough, your meme might float across the desk of the boomer-in-chief, and you never know, you might get a shout-out on this podcast when he says something silly about it. So we're going to move on now. This is into our next segment, but the blessed takes continue. Don't worry about that. We've got more absolutely dogshit takes from Australian politicians coming up, so stay tuned. But why don't we play that sting? Fashy Australia. So while our politicians and media are insisting that we are not America, stating that controversial fact, and painting a picture of this country as a place where police violence isn't an issue, literally this week we had video circulating of a police officer in Redfern, New South Wales, in Sydney, smashing a 16-year-old Indigenous kid's face into the concrete while arresting him. The video shows there's a couple of cops talking to a few kids. The cop is being rude to the kids. He says, "You need to open up your ears." The kid responded, "I'll crack you across the jaw." The cop then, watching the video, he just snaps. Like, it's just obvious that his ego has been bruised. He strides over to the kid, pins his arms behind his back, kicks his legs out from under him, and sends his face directly into the concrete. And it is just an absolutely horrible video to watch. You can hear the kid crying. He's extremely distressed. The people watching are, like, horrified by what's going on. The kid ended up suffering, like, major bruising and scratches, and his teeth were chipped. It's, you know...
And also, it's like, it could have killed him so easily. Like, if he landed on his nose, it could have just instantly killed him. And, you know, there's been that video from the US of those two cops shoving over that 75-year-old dude who then just, like, falls over and starts bleeding out of his ears. And, you know, it's a different situation, obviously, and, like, but... Yeah, so much police violence that doesn't result in death could have, if it had just been like a slightly different angle or something. So I think that's important to remember. This kid was like horrifically injured, but he could be dead.
And, so easily.
Yeah.
So easily. I mean, human bodies are fragile when they're subjected to this kind of trauma, as we've been shown time and again by police. So, this constable has been placed on restricted duties, apparently. The incident is being internally investigated, so that should turn out a great result, I'm sure. But, yeah, I mean, even... it's not even, like, despite the what's going on in the States at the moment. It's actually informed by what is going on in the States. That what's going on in the States has informed the response of New South Wales police and politicians to this. So, I've got this quote, a couple of quotes here I want to read from the New South Wales Police Commissioner, Mick Fuller, in response to this incident. He said, "The fact that this officer doesn't have a checkered history and has been in for 3.5 years, if there certainly is a complaint sustained against him, you would have to say he has had a bad day."
Wait, sorry. So he's saying the fact that this guy hasn't had any complaints made against him in 3.5 years means that this complaint isn't a big deal. But that implies that your average cop does have a checkered history within 3.5 years, right? Like, that's what he's saying.
And is those that, like, that don't one are one cops. Crossword away from smashing a child's face into bricks.
Yes, that too. Yeah, yeah.
That's really all that it takes to turn a good cop into a bad one, apparently.
Yeah. Yep.
Just for a day, though. Just for a day. You know, I'm sure a couple months of paperwork will straighten him right out. Mick Fuller went on to say, "I'm sure most of the community wouldn't want to see someone who has made a mistake sacked after making such a commitment to the community."
You are incorrect about that, Mick. Most of the community want you and this cop to go to jail. So.
Yeah. What? Like... And of course, like, we all exist in our own little bubbles, right? You know, I'm sure that you and I probably feel like there is more anti-cop sentiment amongst the public than is maybe there if you did a comprehensive national survey. But certainly the inverse is true of Mick Fuller, who is surrounded by cops. So when he says, "Oh, I'm sure most of the community wouldn't want to see this guy fired," he's saying, yeah, me and everyone I know who are all cops don't want this guy to lose his job over brutalizing an Aboriginal teenager.
I just sort of wanted to draw two things. Sorry. I mean, you said before about this has been informed by the American protests. And I actually think that probably the cops are as, like, hyped up, if that's the right word, about the protests as anti-police citizens are, you know? Like, this is horrifying, but an exciting time, like, exciting in a terrifying way, if you know what I mean. And I think that is probably, you know, I reckon this cop has probably seen all the footage of his, like, counterparts in the US beating the shit out of civilians and being like, well, that's why I joined up the police force. Like, fuck yeah, I'm going to get some of that for me as well. And, like, not that Australian cops need to be inspired by the US to attack children. black children, but I suspect that probably this cop was, you know, high on the same adrenaline as the rest of the country from watching the US protests and wanted to take part.
Yeah, it's a potent mix of this machismo and bottled up aggression and fear. Like, that's a fucking potent cocktail. These guys are walking around ready to fucking pop off at the slightest thing. This kid was in no way physically threatening to the cop, but he, like, his first response, the very first thing that he did when he was threatened was to immediately turn to extreme violence. Yeah. Just fucking shocking. But so, look, I also wanted to briefly touch on the response of the New South Wales Police Minister, David Elliott, who listeners may remember from the time that he roughed up a teenager for getting into a bingle with him. Or
also pretended to be a police officer.
During that incident? Yep.
Yes.
Or maybe they'll remember him from the time that he advocated for his own children to be strip searched. Or maybe they'll remember him from the time that he posed with illegal firearms and couldn't even hold the gun correctly.
I think that one's my favorite because it's the one where he looks the most clownish but also harmed the least people. So,
Yeah, it's real vintage David Elliott. That's a nice little David Elliott story, that one. He said, "I was just as disturbed about the threat from a young person to physically assault a police officer as I was with the response from the police officer."
What the fuck, dude?
I mean, it doesn't get much clearer than that, does it?
Yeah, yeah.
Saying something potentially threatening to a cop is the same as the cop pushing your face into bricks. That is the official position of the New South Wales Police Minister.
And again, we've seen this in the US constantly. I've been watching a lot of Robert Evans streaming at I Write OK. Listeners, you should check it out. He's been live streaming the protests in Portland, Oregon most nights. And he's been saying that, like, the cops have been saying, you know, you're now out after curfew. This is an illegal gathering. We will fire impact munitions at you. Not we will arrest you or issue you move on orders or ask you to leave or fine you or any of that shit, which we could do. No, we are going straight to violence as our response to this situation. And it's the same in Australia. You know, like, that cop could have done fucking anything. He could have ruined this kid's life by giving him a $5,000 fine for threatening a police officer or something, you know. But instead, he chose to assault him.
I'm sure that shit is coming down the line.
Oh, no doubt.
As well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, what's the saying? Like, to a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
That's exactly it. Yeah, I think that's, really sums it up.
Elliot went on to say, "The important message here is Sydney is not Minnesota." More amazing, insightful commentary from the government about Australia and America being two different countries.
Yeah.
"The situation we had 2 days ago in Sydney was not unprovoked. The response from the police was not unprovoked, even though we have had deaths in custody and we have had a very rocky past in our race relations. I think we need to be reminded that that occurred in the United States."
What the fuck? Ah, yes, a rocky past in our race relations. That's why there's no racism in Australia anymore.
Just the very occasional bad day from a single cop here and there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Australia is not America. Go on.
I was going to say, maybe this guy, David Elliott, he should tell the French protesters in Paris that Paris isn't actually in Minnesota.
That'll come down. Yeah, I don't think that they understood Dave Sharma's tweet because his French isn't very good. So maybe they need David Elliott to reach out and calm them down.
Le cool down.
Yeah. Impeccable French accent.
Thank you.
All right. Now it's time for
Shitpost of the Week.
So this is going to first-time winner, and in fact, very new group member, I believe, Razzie Bayou, who made some tasty OC for Auspol shitposting. Again, listeners, if you're not part of the group, just find us on Facebook. Search for ACAB shitposting. and so this is one of those memes. It's like Muscle Dog and Shitty Dog. That's like, I don't know, it's kind of like a reject modernity, embrace tradition meme, but it's been, I don't know, appropriated away from the alt-right, so it's pretty good. And normally it's like, you know, Romans in 200 AD, we will conquer the globe, and then Romans today, I'm stuck in traffic. Or, I don't, you know, it's like saying that modern people are shit compared to ancient people. And so, anyway,
I love it
one
when
week
you
ago,
invent memes on the spot.
I did see one about Romans. I just can't remember what they were making fun of them for in the present. But so on the left is 1 week ago, this giant muscle doge holding a sign that says COVID-19 is a scam and a crossed out 5G sign. And he says, I am a citizen with rights safer outside than inside. And then today, and it's this like pathetic doge crying, saying, guys, please, there's a better way to protest. The cops said, you got to stay home. Come on.
It's an excellent meme.
It is.
Yeah, amazing how the very same people who were protesting for their right to go outside and infect people at will because they were sick of being in lockdown, trying to turn that shit into some kind of like freedom of speech issue, and now like, oh no, this BLM protest is going to be so bad for the COVID. Super yep. consistent. Love it. Speaking of which, got a couple quotes here from Scott Morrison.
From Scott Morrison, yeah. So,
what did ScoMo say when he was asked about people protesting 5G?
It's a free country.
And what did he say when asked about people protesting about Black Lives Matter?
Don't go. Let's find a better way and another way to express these sentiments.
Very, very consistent and cool stuff from the Prime Minister. There was someone else who also said don't go.
Yes, so this shitpost of the week is sort of an extended one because it we're looking at basically the Australian ruling class's response to these organised protests this weekend. And so obviously that was Scott Morrison. And here we have from Commissioner Comrade Daniel Andrews, Daniel Stalin Andrews, who said, don't go. It will be illegal because of the Chief Health Officer's directions. Oh, no, sorry. This is from Deputy Police Commissioner Shane Patton, sorry. Don't go. It will be illegal because of the Chief Health Officer's directions. We will be issuing infringement to the organizers if it goes ahead and there is greater than 20 people. And they've also said they will fine individuals to a maximum of 1,652. And listeners, I just want to say they've been issuing fines after the fact, including for those 5G people, actually. Cops have been looking at social media later and figuring out who was there and then issuing fines by post or whatever. So just be careful about how you post on social media. Anyway.
I like that you announced at the top of this podcast that we are going.
Oh, yeah. I also identified myself in my pseudo-anonymous social media thing. Whatever. We'll see how we go. Daniel Andrews said this, I've got a very clear message. Do not go to the protest. Police will be quick to act if the protest gets out of control. If it's not peaceful, then it's not a protest. Victoria Police will not hesitate to maintain order and will not tolerate violence. Yeah, no shit, they're not going to tolerate violence. They're going to fucking start it, you piece of shit who has expanded police ranks and funding and militarization excessively and sicked them onto homeless people. Fuck you, Daniel Andrews, most progressive piece of shit in Australia. Fuck off. And fuck you, Labour voters listening to this. You're all pieces of shit, too. No. We love you. Please donate to our Patreon. But it's not only been the actual politicians who have been pieces of shit here. The Age, everyone's favourite fairly conservative but not ultra-conservative newspaper.
Their favourite paper that, at least it's not News Corp.
Yeah, that really should be their tagline. Anyway, The Age released an article with the headline, activists have threatened police command with spitting, inflammatory chanting, and other forms of physical abuse. And this is according to a, quote, unnamed senior government source. And last night, like maybe 12, 15 hours after the article went up, The Age had issued this correction at the bottom of that article, which was largely unchanged. And it said, the headline and opening paragraphs of the original version of the story reported concerns within the Victorian government about the potential for some activists to provoke physical confrontation with police during planned protests. The story fell short of The Age's editorial values, no it didn't, you're all pieces of shit, and standards and caused understandable offence to many members of the community. The claim that some activists have threatened police with spitting and abuse was not backed up beyond one unnamed senior government source. The story put undue emphasis on these claims. The main organizers of the rally, the Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance, clearly stated that they had no knowledge of any threats to police. The Age apologizes for being giant, stinking heaps of shit. I feel like that last line helped a bit. But.
This is entirely about manufacturing consent around...
Yes.
Police violence against protesters. This is all about preemptively excusing the crackdown that they know is coming down the road. And in fact, this article is going to cause violence, not prevent it. And the fact that they consider publishing this absolute garbage, which they won't even put a name to, they consider theoretical spitting and theoretical inflammatory chanting to be more violent than... police violence is
smacking people in the head with batons.
Fucking and mind blowing.
And I just want to repeat that quote from Daniel Andrews: "Victoria Police will not hesitate to maintain order and will not tolerate violence." And like, just putting that in combination with this article from The Age, it just really makes it so transparent what you said about manufacturing consent for violence. Like, Daniel Andrews being like, "Hey, protesters, if you get fucked up tomorrow, it's your own fault." And The Age being like, "Actually, this protest tomorrow, all of the violence that's going to happen, it's the protesters' fault, just so as you know."
The maintaining order is a fucking hell of a euphemism for hitting people with batons and using tear gas, like pepper spray.
While we're talking about The Age, I just wanted to mention, there's a lot of complicity in the media class, and we try and talk about this on the show often, but one thing that we don't talk about all that much is like the gymnastic headline writing, which is a phrase that Zach used last night, which I really liked. For example, this article from from SBS saying "man dead after police shooting," or like that kind of shit happens all the time. "Man found dead after police raid, bullets discharged," or whatever. Right? They like use this passive voice. They don't even say, like, the police allegedly killed a man. They just, like, someone found dead with bullets fired from police guns, you know. And it seems like a small thing that anyone with, like, critical reading skills will know what they mean. But, like, every little piece of pro-cop propaganda adds up to cops getting let off for killing people and beating the shit out of innocent passers-by. So, yeah.
And they're, like, perceived objectivity that our media is supposed to have does affect the way that this stuff is read. I know that it affects me. I try to think critically about this stuff, but I find myself digesting these headlines and the way that they're framed uncritically all the time, and it's not until that it's later pointed out to me, like, oh no, this is actually a fucked way to frame that it sometimes becomes clear, because that's just, you know, how you're conditioned. But the past couple of weeks has been amazing to watch the way that papers have responded to public outcry over their terrible headline writing. In particular, there's a tool that you can use that like tracks the changes of headlines, and people have been posting some amazing results from that. And it's a lot of American newspapers where people have been following that stuff. But I mean, this article in The Age, they changed that headline like two or three times after they got just thoroughly fucking ratioed after they posted the article on Twitter. They changed it like a couple of times, basically, again, just slightly tweaking words here and there to see how much they can say without getting shattered down. Because it's exactly what we said it was. It's manufacturing consent. What's the best way to phrase this to make it sound like the police violence that is going to happen in the future is justified? How can we justify that in advance without getting jumped on? But it's not just the media and politicians. Obviously, it's the cops themselves who are trying to get in the way of these protests even going ahead. Noon, do you want to take us through briefly what's been happening with the New South Wales Black Lives Matter solidarity protest?
Yes. So the New South Wales police took the organizers to court to declare the rally illegal because of coronavirus. It was an extremely last-minute case, and the cops were still printing documents in the courtroom after the proceedings had begun. And eventually they sat for like 3 hours past the time that the court normally closes, and the judge found against the protesters, finding that the protest is illegal. It's unclear what that's going to mean. My guess is that it's going to mean there's going to be more and bigger fines for the organizers and more violence and more brutal violence from the police because it's now like officially illegal or whatever. And there was this quote from Gladys Berejiklian, "We can't afford to have exceptions for anybody, except, as we have already noted, all of the exceptions that they made for fucking 5G protesters and like anti-lockdown protesters and shit.
Or rich people going to the NFL. Not to
mention the reopening
fucking,
stadiums.
Like, schools and shopping centers.
Saunas and bathhouses.
There are like, so many places where people are gathering in numbers larger than 20. And they're not getting taken to the fucking high court.
Well, I wonder why that could be. Yeah.
I literally have no idea, Noon.
I actually think there's something interesting here because I am not a law talky guy. So if any listeners who understand this shit on any level whatsoever beyond like casual article reading know anything about this, please weigh in. But the judge, Justice Keegan, found that the BLM rally organizers said something along the lines of, even if you find this protest illegal, thousands of people will come anyway. So it would be safer to make it official so that we can, like, have the police help do social distancing or whatever. You know, like, that this illegal finding won't make a difference one way or the other. And the judge basically was like, well, that's not true. People won't come. There were other points that he used to justify his position against the thing. Like, I don't think that was a major one. I think he was basically like, the minister said it's illegal for corona reasons, and that's the most important thing, and we're not, like, taking away your right to protest. We're just, quote, deferring it. For how long, Justice Keegan? But, yeah, like, I don't really know, but the judge seems to have decided something that was presented in evidence was not true, without any evidence to support his view on that, and then used that to justify a ruling against the constitutional right to, like, political assembly. So I wonder if there's going to be appeals about this. They can appeal to the Supreme Court, but it seems unlikely because I don't know what they'd get from it. Anyway, I just think that's an interesting legal situation. We have another quote here from David Elliott, who said, anyone who goes to a protest during the coronavirus pandemic is certifiably insane. He said he'd stayed up half the night getting legal advice, but, quote, there are things in our society that are just virtually impossible to stop, and the right for political freedom is one of them. A fucking mask off, dude. Like, yeah, we get it. You don't want us to have any political power, contribution, solidarity. Like, you'd
stop us
voting if you
could. Oh, it'd be so convenient
if
we could just stop people expressing themselves politically, but God dang it, those laws are just too tough.
We'll just have to hit them with clubs instead. And I just wanted to finish off this bit with a quote from Maria Clegg, who's an Aboriginal activist who I've met who is a badass. And she said, when the beaches were packed, were the police doing this? When the ship was allowed back into the country when the coronavirus spread, it was silent. But now suddenly a black life is taken. We are ready to take it to the streets and demand justice for the black lives, bodies, and land, which we have every single right to do. It is our right to take to the streets. Fuck yeah.
Boom. All right, so we're going to move on now. This will be our last segment for the show, and this is going to be about police and state violence against Aboriginal people. So a warning that we're going to be discussing discussing the details of a lot of violence against Aboriginal people from police, and there are also recordings of voices of Indigenous people who have died. So a heads up on that. That's what the rest of the show is going to be. So if you don't want to hear that, now is probably the time to switch off. But yeah, a general content warning beyond that we're going to be going through a few cases of Indigenous people being murdered by the police in the state that have happened in this country over the last few years. This was partially inspired by something that other podcasts in the States are doing. They're calling it a podcast blackout, where instead of releasing their regular episode, they are listing the names of African American people who have been murdered by the police. Inspired by that, we are going to just list off a few of these people who have been killed by cops, and just talk a little bit about the circumstances around their killings and try to talk a little bit about what they were like as people. Just so that, I mean, I don't know about you, Noon, but even though a number of these cases are stuff, things that we've talked about on the show before, it starts to become a little bit of a blur after a while. Details kind of fall away and there's, you know, case after case and it becomes hard to kind of keep them straight. And I feel like there's a danger of it becoming, for someone like me, a white guy, dangerously abstract. And I thought that given the protests happening around the country this week, that it was a good idea to try and actively remember these cases and discuss them in detail and not allow them to just become, I guess, statistics in my own head. And and hopefully our listeners find that helpful as well. So first off, I wanted to talk about TJ Hickey, who, as someone who grew up in New South Wales, I mean, this was probably the first killing of an Aboriginal person by the police that I was aware of. So TJ Hickey was killed in February of 2004 in Redfern, New South Wales. He was a 17-year-old Gamilaroi boy. He was thrown off his bike while running from the police and impaled on a fence. Cops claim that it was a, quote, freak accident, but eyewitnesses say that the cops clipped his bike with their car, and there were huge inconsistencies in the cops' stories and statements after the fact. So both Bob Carr, who was the New South Wales Premier at the time, and John Howard, who was the Prime Minister, weighed in them because it was, you know, it's a big media story, saying that they believed the cops, and eventually no one was held accountable for his death. You know, they claim that they weren't even pursuing him directly. The police say that they were looking for someone else and that TJ just started running of his own accord. But even if that's true, why would a 17-year-old kid be so terrified by the presence of police that he feels that he has to run on site? Like, even if, and this is highly doubtful, but even if they weren't wrongfully pursuing him, the atmosphere of and threat of systemic racist violence is what killed him, even if that's what they claim is true. So in the wake of his death were what the media termed the Redfern riots, where the community from the local area of the housing estates there, which are known as the Block, they threw stuff at cops and set the train station on fire briefly. And that was a big news item and is, you know, is one of the main reasons that TJ's death is remembered. But every year on the anniversary of his death, TJ's mum organizes a memorial protest. And there's always a huge police presence at each one of those. So TJ was, he was an older brother to six younger sisters. And was reading through the news reports from around the time, and I found this detail, which I found kind of moving. His favorite song was Baby Boy by Big Brothers, who were an R&B act that were big in the early 2000s, UK act. And that was the song that was chosen to open his funeral. It was chosen by his girlfriend, April. Yeah, I mean, I remember being a kid around that time and watching Rage and that song being in the charts. I mean, you know, I don't know. There was something kind of very specific about that fact that really got to me. I don't know.
So next I wanted to talk about Cameron Mulrenji Domaji, who was killed in November of 2004 on Palm Island. He was 36 years old and he was out with people who said that he was happy drunk and was singing Who Let the Dogs Out. And he was arrested for public nuisance, which is to say for swearing. And he was found dead with a burst liver, four broken ribs, a ruptured portal vein and a hemorrhaging pancreas. The arresting officer claimed that he had tripped and fallen over a step, but it seems pretty obvious that he was beaten to death. And this triggered the Palm Island uprising, which we've talked about a bit in the last couple of weeks. The cop's response to that was ruled racist by the federal court, and residents received compensation. And obviously, there's been a bunch of super racist reporting about that compensation in the last month or so. And his son, whose name's Eric, died by suicide 2 years later, and he was 18. The officer who arrested Cameron Dumaji, a man named Sergeant Chris Hurley, was acquitted of manslaughter by an all-white jury. Manslaughter, that is, not murder. He was acquitted by an all-white jury and was later suspended without pay for putting a white man in a chokehold at a traffic stop, which obviously, touching a white man is so much more of an offense for a police officer than literally killing a black man. And at the inquest into his death, Cameron's partner, a woman named Tracy Tweddle, said this: "We had a simple but happy life together. He was unselfish, he was caring, and he tried to do the right thing by the people. He'd help anybody. He didn't care what color they were, he wasn't mean, he was always caring. He was always there for me and his mum and his family, and Cameron was always joking and ready for a laugh, you know, he always lifted our spirits. I think he saw the good and right in life, and he never sat around and brooded over things. And in a way, he was an inspiration to me because I used to watch him and, you know, think, gee, he knew how to enjoy his life. He was content. It was a simple life and happy."
Next, I wanted to talk about David Dungay, whose story has been in and out of the news pretty frequently over the past couple of years. So in November 2015... he was in the mental health unit of Long Bay Jail Hospital in New South Wales. He's a 26-year-old Dungutty man, and he had diabetes and schizophrenia. Guards stormed his cell after he refused to stop eating a packet of biscuits. He was pinned down by 5 guards and injected with a sedative by a nurse. He said, "I can't breathe," 12 times before he died of asphyxiation. So his family was waiting years for the results of a coronial inquest, and eventually the coroner found that there was no reason for the guards to have used force against him. But the coroner also said that none of the 5 guards should face any kinds of consequences, saying that their actions were, quote, "limited by systemic efficiencies in training and was not motivated by malicious intent, but was a product of misunderstanding." Jeez. In other words, the coroner basically found that David Dungay died as a result of systemic racism, but then also used that as an excuse for the individuals who actually killed him. Which is
sort of its own sort of meta systemic racism, right? Of like they're like, "Oh yeah, there's systemic racism. That's why we can't punish these active racist murderers."
Just shocking. Yeah, truly shocking. I mean, his family has been through so much trying to get justice for him. David's nephew, Paul Silva, was interviewed recently in The Guardian in the wake of the George Floyd protests. And he said this: "When I heard him say, 'can't breathe' for the first time, I had to stop it," talking about the footage of George Floyd being murdered by cops. "My thoughts really go out to the family and everyone on the streets in the USA. My solidarity is with them because I do know the pain they are feeling." And just to round off this discussion of David, I wanted to play a clip from a Guardian podcast called Breathless, which is about David's death and his family's fight for justice. And they have this recording of a phone call that David made to his sister earlier in the day, on the day that he died.
"It's just a general call that a brother would make to a sister.
What, do they give you lollies for you when you go low?
Nah, they give me Weet-Bix and that. Or sandwiches, extra sandwiches and that. Or not extra sandwiches, bread. Bread jam.
No, you know how we used to give you, you
know, lollies, yeah, jelly beans and jats. Remember when Mum used to buy it?
Yeah. What? You right, buddy?
Yeah, I'm right.
Been strong there, old.
Yeah, been strong, yeah. Keep my head up. Keep my head and chin up. Yeah. Oi.
Oi, oi.
Oh,
can you hear me?
Yeah, what?
Ring up tomorrow.
Yeah. I'll ring tomorrow and say, "I love leaving it." Yeah, lunchtime after lunch, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, all right then, sis. I'll ring
all
tomorrow
then.
Love you. See you then,
love
boy.
Love you.
Take care. I'll send you a card, too. I sent you a card, Christmas card, for you and the kids and Maury. Yeah, all right then, sis.
Yeah, so speaking there about, you know, how he's managing his...
Diabetes.
Diabetes in prison, yeah.
Hmm. And, like, that the broadcaster sort of said there, like, it's just a normal phone call that people make, and, yeah, I think it's really important to remember these people are just people, you know, they've just got lives and families and just trying to get on with shit, and then they get murdered. Which is also the story with Tanya Day, who we've spoken about at great length on the show. She was killed in December of 2017 in Castlemaine in Victoria. She was a 55-year-old Yorta Yorta woman, and she was arrested for public drunkenness while she was asleep on a train. And she fell and hit her head several times while she was in a cell in police custody. The police didn't check on her as they were required to do, as they're and she died 17 days later in hospital from a brain hemorrhage. And the coroner found, "I'm not of the view that there is evidence to make a finding that the differential treatment was due to Miss Day's aboriginality, but she had found that Tanya would still be alive if she hadn't been arrested." And I think it was also extremely clear that she wouldn't have been arrested if she wasn't Aboriginal. The train driver said that he'd never called the cops on someone sleeping before, and there was basically zero chance that he would have done that for a white person, but... The coroner referred the case to the Department of Public Prosecutions. And before she was killed, Tanya was on a health kick, and she had just joined a gym and shared photos of health food that she was cooking. And she was also organizing a fundraiser for the family of Tane Chatfield, who died in police custody earlier in 2017. The last thing that she shared on Facebook was a news story about his death. And I don't know, that I think just really kind of shows how unending this is. You know, in a story about a black woman being murdered, we find another story about a black person being murdered in police custody.
Yeah, the violence the police inflict on people doesn't end with the individual. It ripples out to their family and their community. And as we saw with... The killing of Cameron Doomadgee, you know, his son dying by suicide shortly afterwards. And it's a similar story with Joyce Clark, who was killed in September of 2019 in Geraldton, Western Australia. She was a 29-year-old Yamatji woman. Cops got a call about a woman acting erratically. When they got to the scene, Joyce was holding a knife, apparently. One of the cops shot her in the stomach, and she died shortly afterwards in hospital. That cop has just this week entered a not guilty plea, and he's out on bail. There's also a bit of a fight happening around the location of the trial. The defense team is pushing to have the trial in Geraldton, but the family wants it held in Perth. And I'm just going to read this quote from an NITV article. Miss Clark's mother, Anne Jones, has told NITV News that she wants the trial to remain in Perth to avoid media potentially misrepresenting the Aboriginal community in Geraldton. Got this quote from her. She says, "He, the accused, knows if it's held in Geraldton, the community will rally and then the media will use that to put the story his way," she said. So just having to be conscious that the trial of the person who murdered your daughter is not going to be fair, because if the media descends on your community, that they, you know, that they are going to paint you in a horrible light, in a discriminatory way. Just, yeah, look, it's literally inconceivable to someone like me. And you know, just the ways that the multiple ways, the varying different kinds of forms of oppression that are all visited upon Indigenous people in these circumstances, just so upsetting. There's just no relief. And two other members of Joyce Clark's family died by suicide in the months following her killing. The suicide rate amongst Yamatji people is 7 times the national average. In Geraldton, there's an Aboriginal health service called the Geraldton Regional Aboriginal Medical Service, is drastically underfunded. The director of the National Suicide Prevention Project has said that the cops never should have been called to respond to the Joyce Clark situation, and they wouldn't have been had there been a properly funded Indigenous health service in the region. Mm. So, as you say, Noon, it's not just these direct acts of violence by police, but things like underfunding Indigenous health services lead directly to death as well. All these different things that contribute and need to be considered as contributing to the ongoing genocide of Aboriginal people. Joyce Clark left behind a daughter, and Joyce herself likely suffered from undiagnosed fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. She struggled with complex mental health issues for her entire life, and she was basically, from a really young age, institutionalized and criminalized and ultimately killed as a result of these problems.
Kumanjaya Walker was killed at the end of last year in November 2019 in Yuendamu in the Northern Territory, which is a rural community about 2.5 hours out of Alice. And he was a 19-year-old Walpri man. Two cops came to his grandmother's house to arrest him for a suspended sentence, which he was planning on taking himself to the police the next day after a funeral. And the cops didn't have a warrant, but the Northern Territory has intervention laws, which basically means the cops can do whatever they want. And so they entered the house anyway. And one officer claims to have been stabbed, and they shot Kumanjaya in front of his family and girlfriend. And he was badly injured, but not dead, and they dragged him into the back of the wagon while pointing a gun at his family and threatening to shoot anyone who followed them. The witnesses, his family, deny that he had a weapon, and there's also inconsistencies in the police story here. They didn't get him any medical care, and there are some reasons for that that I don't think are necessarily super important to talk about right now. But he died in police custody that evening by 9 p.m. But they didn't tell any of his family or the community until the next morning, more than 10 hours later. The community had sort of rallied outside the police station to try and find out what was going on with this kid who was lying dead a few meters away from them inside the cell that they didn't find out about until the next day. The officer who shot him was charged with murder, which is unusual, but he was bailed out within a few hours in extremely unusual circumstances. The judge who bailed him out did so in very weird and unusual situations. And the officer remains out of jail, suspended with pay as legal proceedings continue. And there's sort of a similar thing as what you were talking about with Joyce Clark, that the legal proceedings and the location of them are a major issue. The cops have been trying to have this heard in Alice Springs, but the family want it held, the trial held near Yuendamu, so they can go and participate in it, but the cops want it as far away from them as possible to prevent them from being present while they try the man who killed their son, grandson. And Kumanjaya had a long-term girlfriend, a partner, whose name was Keisha, and he was very close with her family and grandparents who came to his grandmother's house after he was shot and then to the police station. And we just wanted to play this little clip from an interview with his cousin, whose name is Samara Fernandez Brown. And I think we'll probably end the show at the end of that clip. So.
I want to ask you one more question, Samara, and that is, what was Kumanjaya Walker like? How do you want him to be remembered?
First of all, I think he just needs to be remembered as a human being. Like, he's someone's cousin, you know, he's someone's son, he's someone's brother. I think, everybody's got memories of him. I think you've just got to hold on to the good ones. He, just remember that he's loved, you know, like, we've all got cousins, we've all got brothers, we've all got, like, the family members. Just remember the love that you have for them. You've got to connect with him as an individual, not as another statistics.